The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black man, by police, and the deaths of Freddie Gray and Eric Garner in police custody, America's underlying racial inequality has been thrust into the spotlight. While thousands of people protested or shared opinions about the brutality, others stood on the sidelines, having no idea how to talk about race. Among them, middle-class white Americans who'd be quick to say they aren't racist and think, this is not my issue or mess to clean up. Some may consider themselves colorblind, but remain oblivious to the experiences of people of color. Many are just afraid of saying the wrong thing. Debbie Irving grew up with the values and inherent privileges of her New England WASP class. She's now a racial justice advocate. Her memoir, Waking Up White, follows her realization that believing she's a good person with the empathy and energy to help people of color actually perpetuated her clueless notions of race. Debbie Irving, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So what does Waking Up White mean?
For me, it means waking up to the fact that I'm part of a history and a set of housing and lending and education and ongoing systems that through history have simultaneously advantaged white people. And I'm a member of the white race. I can't help but have benefited from that. And I knew nothing about it. So waking up means learning what I didn't know I didn't know.
And this began a long time ago, a question you asked your mother when you were just 5 years old. What happened to all the Indians? Now, what did she tell you, and what does that reveal about your upbringing?
She said to me, they drank themselves to death.
Wow.
And it's an appalling answer, and I will tell you that my mother was a wonderful person. She was highly educated. Private school, Smith College, empathetic, warm, never spoke poorly about people behind their back. And she said to me, you know, they were lovely people, and they just couldn't handle it. It brought them down. And what it reveals is the inherited ignorance, because she's not alive for me to ask, where did you ever get that story? But I can imagine, because I believed it when she said it to me. I believe that she believed it from someone else who told her, and maybe that person had very scarce information they were operating on. That is a tiny piece of a larger truth, but without the larger truth, that tiny piece paints a picture that portrays Indians as weak, and that is not the case.
Well, growing up in Winchester, Massachusetts, you learned, like many other WASPs, to stifle your feelings. Kind of grew up with this attitude of optimism, which was very different than that of those who, people of color in America, who are prepared for a hostile world. I'm thinking of, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates in his recent memoir writes about his father beating with him with a belt and saying, you know, either I can beat him or the police.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what did that mean, having that attitude of optimism?
Well, it meant a lot of things. You know, for me, in addition to the world, the white bubble of the white suburb I was growing up in, the world was coming to me through television shows like Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and the Brady Bunch. And, you know, the biggest problems that were ever presented to me were solved in 30 minutes or less. And it also meant if I feel that I am in a world where anything is possible, that gives me a lot of wingspan in terms of dreaming and taking risks. And I did not have to worry when I stepped out of the house that I needed to be looking over my shoulder, or that I didn't have to contend because of my skin color with low expectations. I did have to do a little bit of that as a female, but never did I have to worry that people would think I was not smart or that I was uppity because of my skin color.
So much later, the awakening begins for you at a class at Wheelock College, and you eventually, in this book, you point to understanding whiteness as being a key to understanding racism. So what does whiteness mean to you?
Well, I think, so what's important to understand is that I spent 48 years thinking race and racism belonged to black and brown people, and I never thought to look within myself for answers. And what whiteness means to me is that it is the social construct that our country, that the United States of America, is founded on. And there was a legal category, white, that was invented in order to preserve resources and rights for white people. And so whiteness means all of that. And it means, if you look at the history of immigration, whiteness plays a huge role because it became paramount for anybody coming to this country whether or not they could be considered white. So Italian, Irish, Jews eventually were considered white. Other people who, we see it with the Latino population today, all kinds of Asian populations, lobbied to be considered white, and they weren't. And so they were denied citizenship, and they were subject to all kinds of stereotypes. But whiteness also includes all of the cultural norms that hold that in place. So avoidance of conflict is a key one. So if it's becomes normalized to not pose agitating questions in public, and the risk of doing that can ostracize you, you can lose your job, you can lose your status in a community, then we're not able to challenge the status quo. And that's a key component of whiteness.
And beyond the attitudes are norms. There is a great deal of institutional racism that has maintained privilege for white people. What are some examples of that?
Well, there are current examples, but I think there's no better institutional example than the GI Bill and the way it played out after World War II. It feels long ago, but its remnants are largely responsible for what we see going on in neighborhoods that get fingered as violent and irresponsible, you know, ghettos today. Those were laid down in the mid-1900s. With housing and lending policies, where that lenders would not lend in neighborhoods where even one or two black families lived, whereas they would lend at low rates in neighborhoods like Winchester. So when you take a look at the GI Bill, this is how multiple institutions intersect. GI Bill says, hey, you World War II veterans coming home from the war, we're going to give you free higher education and low interest rate federal government-backed loans to buy a home. My father took advantage of both of those, Harvard Law School, home in Winchester. That bill was not available to 1 million, most of the 1 million black GIs who had also fought in World War II, because the loans would not go into a neighborhood where even one or two black families lived. And then on the education front, there was a quota system, and those spots filled up immediately. And there's even more to the story, but to give you a short version, that's how institutional racism works.
Well, I know that you are trying to normalize the conversation and get real with entangling and engaging in white privilege. But why do I feel weird and even suspect as one middle-class white woman talking to another? I'm in New Hampshire, among the whitest of states, about the realization of white privilege.
Why do you feel awkward? Is that the question when you're talking about it?
I guess it's a question for me, but you went through it, so I'd like to hear about your experience.
And I will tell you that white people all over the country are confessing to me, yeah, I feel that too. It's because we were taught not to talk about it. And if you're not talking about a subject, you have no language for it. Then you layer onto that that there is this norm about creating conflict and looking good. You know, you don't want to appear stupid, or you don't want to be offensive. You don't want to appear to be a boat rocker. So even bringing up the subject can be, uh-oh, here's a rabble rouser. Then you get in. I feel like it's a little bit like you learn a new language and you know how to say hello to someone, but as soon as they say something back to you, you go into paralysis because you don't know anything else other than hello. So that once you enter into these conversations, they are very likely to get rocky and contentious. And that if you're taught not to engage in conflict, you don't develop conflict navigation skills or even conversational skills that help us navigate through conflict. So I think that's why. And the other thing for me is that having been exposed to racial stereotypes my whole life, I can be sitting across the table talking to a good friend or colleague, even now, even after all the work I've done, and bubbling up into my head will be these negative stereotypes. And it makes me feel like a jerk. And oh my God, you know, what if one of these words slips out of my mouth when I'm in mid-conversation? So that's another layer. And those internalized ideas, images, words, that is natural. That does not make us bad. But it does, if, until we get in touch with them and say, wow, look at what all those cartoons and all that lack of exposure to positive images of Black and brown people, look what it's done to me. If you can't get to the point of acknowledging that, then you sort of stuff down those biases and deny they exist. And I think that actually makes them try to bubble up harder and make those moments more awkward.
Well, I think it also makes me feel very self-conscious because we're taking this issue of race and in a way making it about us, the white people, again.
Mm. So there's a term for that, and that's called centering whiteness. And, you know, it threatens to, you know, recenter whiteness in a way that now white is the focus once again. And yet, it is crucial to understand how whiteness operates. If whiteness were not a thing, if race had not been invented by white people, racism, which is the ability to use power to enforce policy around race, if that had not been invented by white people, there would be nothing to discuss. And so it is the context. If we don't think of it as a center, but we think of it as the landscape, it is crucial to understand the landscape that creates discrimination, poverty, the achievement gap in education, differential lifespans. I know you had a show on last week talking about the way racism shows up in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Every sector of our society suffers from a racial divide in terms of how people experience it and in terms of what outcomes are. There is one connecting landscape for all of that, one context for that, and that is whiteness. And that's why whiteness is so crucial to understand.
I'm speaking with Debbie Irving about her experience of growing up sheltered from genuine understanding of institutional racism and eventually coming to understand what it means to benefit from white privilege in America. Her new memoir is called Waking Up White. Well, you began to engage earnestly with people of color in classes and workshops and conferences. And right, you know, sometimes it's cringeworthy reading this about how you've been humbled or humiliated even and forced to reckon with your own, your good intentions, your unconscious belief that you can help, that you have more to offer in this struggle for equality than someone who is less privileged. Can you give us an example of that and how that played out in your mind?
Yeah, and let me also add that I really identified as a good person because of that impulse. I thought that was what made me a good person, that desire to help and fix. And, well, one example, and this is in the book, is I was the general manager of First Night, and one of my charges was to bring together the multiple neighbors, the diverse neighborhoods of Boston, into a single New Year's Eve celebration. And I felt completely entitled to design the program without the input of a lot of people. And I had access, because of the social circles I'd grown up in, I had access to write grants and get money and, you know, raise the money to create these great inner city, quote-unquote inner city programs. And my idea was, wouldn't it be great to partner these after-school programs, who were disproportionately Black and brown children, with artists who were disproportionately white, have them create artworks and bring them down to the New Year's Eve celebration. So I thought that that was a great idea, and in some ways it was a good idea, but what I did not anticipate and was really hard for me to hear was that it was terrifying for those people who had been, for the children and the families, you know, their parents and their siblings, their aunts and uncles who had come down to the festival. It was terrifying for them to come into a huge white crowd, so that maybe making the art was interesting to them, but the actual experience of coming to the event was terrifying. That really sobered me.
You live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and ask yourself, you know, despite living in this multicultural environment, do I always end up with white people? What is it that keeps white people in their enclaves? You mentioned earlier, you know, the fear of messing up or fear of saying the wrong thing. Is that it?
I think that's a part of it, you know. So we're talking about just that awkwardness. I'm afraid of saying something stupid or offensive. Well, when you're wanting to kind of let down your guard and hang out with your closest friends and family, that's not a time when you choose to be around people that you feel sort of an underlying nervousness around. So that was part of it for me. But the other part of it is people of color really, you know, they have to be with white people. If they're trying to put together a living, they're educating themselves in white spaces, they're working in white spaces. When they need to unwind at the end of a day, they don't want to be around white people who really don't understand what racism is, how it works, or how even the most well-intentioned white person can be sort of oppressive. And, you know, white cultural norms are oppressive. We talk about the weather. We talk about light things. We deny racism exists. We say, oh, we're all the same. I love all people. We're all just human. Those are things that are surprisingly offensive. And so there's a culture clash. And at the end of the day, I think people of color are exhausted. They need to refuel. They do not need to be hanging out with white people. And that's, I'm not speaking for all people of color or all white people, but I think that that's a trend that keeps us separate. And I will tell you, my life has changed drastically. As soon as I could start talking about racism from my experience as a white person, as opposed to going, oh, that sounds terrible, what you have to go through. As soon as I could own my piece of it, all my relationships with friends of color changed almost overnight.
But isn't there a danger of saying, you know, I want to live in a multicultural world with other people, of sort of crediting yourself with having all of these multicultural friends? You know, isn't that in itself a danger of stepping over this line of, oh, I belong, I'm cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like I'm accumulating friends and look at me, like it's a badge of honor. Yeah, I mean, I think that that is a danger, and I think that I was guilty of that earlier. I think it really changes when, see, when I hear the term multicultural, it means white as much as anything else. As soon as I start to say multicultural isn't something that belongs to other people, ethnicity isn't something that belongs to other people, race isn't something that belongs to other people only, but I'm a part of that formula. And in fact, my race, my ethnicity, my cultural piece that I bring to a multicultural environment is crucial for me to stay aware, be on top of, and be aware of. Then you move from accumulating multicultural friends to building authentic friendships.
Well, you know that police departments across the U.S. must be training their forces and having seminars on race and talking about racial identity, which is being talked about in the news. And a plurality of voices have joined the Black Lives Matter movement. What, Debbie, do you think this particular moment, this opportunity means for America going forward in a conversation about race?
Well, I think we've been here sort of many times before, and this is one of those classic moments where it's a crisis which presents an opportunity. And the question is this the moment where race will really be deeply understood, our racial history and the way it impacts individuals and the way we see ourselves and see the world around us? Or will it be a time to clamp down, increase controls, and double down on the oppressiveness that racism is? You know, there was slavery, that's off the books. There were Jim Crow laws, all kinds of segregationist policies, those are off the books. Now's the time to understand our history and the way it has impacted us psychologically, behaviorally, and in terms of the attitudes that we bring into the world. This is the big work. If we were in a marriage, it would be like, okay, the affair is over. Now let's dig into what that did to us. So it's a time to go inside, go deep, really understand the issue, and move forward in a multicultural way. Not white people saying, here's how we're going to move forward, but really white people letting go and allowing multicultural committees, forums, boards, agencies. I mean, this is why diversifying is important. And then leveling the conversational playing field, changing the conversational power dynamics so that we can recreate the way America operates as a multicultural society. And there are some people who flat out don't want that. I'm more interested in talking to the people who want it, but can't quite understand what undermines that intention.
Well, Debbie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
Debbie Irving is author of the book Waking Up White, a memoir about her path to understanding the role racism played in her own life as a New England WASP. You can find more about her book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What's in a name? Well, it depends who's asking. If you're looking for a job, you are 50% less likely to get a call back if your name is Lakeisha or Jamal than an Emily or a Brendan. In other words, if your name sounds black. That's according to a University of Chicago study and reflected in the corporate world, where there are now just 5 black CEOs heading Fortune 500 companies. Google revealed recently that only 2% of its global workforce is black and 3% Hispanic. In the literary realm, however, sounding ethnic is perceived as an advantage. At least it was by Michael Derrick Hudson. He submitted a poem to the journal Prairie Schooner under the pseudonym Yifen Cho.
Here, sir, that's the very place Jesus wept. The Colosseum sprouts and blooms with leftover seeds pooped by ancient tigers. Poseidon diddled Philomel in the warm slap of this ankle-deep surf to the dying stings of 1,000 jellyfish. There, probably, atop yonder scraggly hillock, Adam should have said no to Eve.
That's just a bit of Hudson's poem, selected by guest editor Sherman Alexie for inclusion in the 2015 Best American Poetry Anthology. Alexie then discovered the author's true identity, but decided to include it anyway, and that is when things blew up.
It's complicated because Alexie is a Native American writer. He's, you know, been very upfront about wanting to promote other writers of color, just more diversity in general in this anthology. So he was quite tortured about this. And he came under a lot of fire, including from people who admire him generally. But he ultimately said, yes, he had given this fellow's poem an extra look because he had made the assumption that he was Chinese American. But ultimately, he really did include the poem because, as he wrote, I love it. And he said he was tempted, or at least thought about, dropping the poem because of this deception. But ultimately, he thought that if he dropped the poem, it would mean that the only reason he included any of the other poems that were in there was because of some consideration of the poet's identity rather than just poetic quality, which for him is really what it was about. He did like this poem.
That's Jenny Schuessler. She's Culture Desk reporter for the New York Times and has been following this story. Hudson has not talked to the press, but in his Best American Poetry author's note, was pretty frank about his motive. The poem had been rejected 40 times under his own name, but only 9 times before being accepted under the name Yifen Cho. In other words, Hudson thought that he was getting over on the poetry publishing deck that's stacked against white men. That perceived advantage of ethnicity is something the writer Jenny Zhang felt acutely when she was at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, one of the most prestigious programs in the country.
Some of my white cohorts felt like they wouldn't be noticed as much as me because they were just, white people, which seems crazy because it certainly doesn't reflect that the age of white people writing literature and being praised for it is over if you go into any bookstore or read any major publication that has book reviews.
There is a decent contingent of white male writers who believe the social justice movement has put them at a structural disadvantage. As Gia Tolentino wrote in Jezebel, the fact that these white male writers are not the default anymore truly bothers them. This is not a demographic accustomed to being prejudged. However outnumbered they may feel, white writers are published and reviewed in literary outlets 9-1 over non-whites. But the publishing business is contracting and competition to be noticed expanding.
I remember one time this one girl was saying that I had an identity and an ethnicity that I could write about that people were interested in, and that she was sort of looking for one that she could insert and use in her fiction, ideally one that not that many people knew about, so that she could sort of have the same, you know, the same edge that you have because you write about your Chinese identity. Sometimes it would be very coded as well, where agents would come visit and meet with graduate students at Iowa, and people, you know, would just say, like, I probably didn't need to say much more than that I was writing about Chinese American immigrants in America, and the agent would be interested.
That's Jenny Zhang again. Her essay for BuzzFeed called They Pretend to Be Us While Pretending We Don't Exist joined the conversation that erupted on Twitter and other online outlets after Best American Poetry came out earlier this month.
Another hysterical white man, envious of the few people of color who've breached their quarantine. Michael Derek Hudson wanted to humiliate poets of color who dared to believe, however briefly, America wanted us, our whole selves. This guy calls it a strategy. It's actually called yellowface.
A sardonic white pen name generator appeared online, along with the hashtag #ActualAsianPoet and a fake feed from Michael Derek Hudson with posts like this.
I just realized I might have gotten two poems accepted if I applied as biracial.
Be sure to read my #BestAmericanPoetry2015 poem, Me Chinese, Me Play Joke.
Using a pen name to get published is an old tactic. Marianne Evans famously used George Eliot to publish Middlemarch and other now classics of English language literature, but that was in the 19th century. Jewish writers used pseudonyms in Stalin's Russia. In both cases, noms de plume chipped away at a system weighted against them and had nothing to do with the quality of the work. The poet Rigoberto Gonzalez told The Times that Hudson's ruse played into an anxiety among non-white writers, that they are included as tokens, which throws the question of whose work deserves to be published into the mix.
But I think one thing that's quite interesting is that a lot of the outrage on Twitter assumed that this guy was a terrible poet and that this poem was a piece of junk. And that in itself seems to me, and seemed to a lot of other people, to be a little bit troublesome. Why would it be assumed that someone like Sherman Alexie would have chosen a bad poem, or that a poem by a Chinese American that had maybe been given some extra consideration in the selection process was not in fact a good poem? And our poetry critic for the New York Times Book Review, the poetry columnist David Orr, published a very brief assessment of it in the Times, and he seemed to think it was a pretty decent poem. He didn't think it was a great poem.
Tokenism backs working writers of color like Jenny Zhang into a kind of corner. She's asked to comment and wants to because she's so offended. But discussing race is not the business she wants to be in.
Anytime a publication doesn't have enough writers of color, they'll think of me, or if a reading or a panel is composed of entirely white writers, they'll think of me. And I guess that's something that I'm supposed to be grateful for. But often it feels like a burden. It feels like I have to always be representing Asian Americans or people of color. I have to be burdened with educating white writers and poets. I'm fetishized for my identity and not paid for my labor.
Do you resent even having this kind of conversation? Because it seems like you have a real opinion on this from your essay.
You know, I don't resent this conversation, but I resent the larger world and society we live in, where conversations about race and racism are structured around scandal or controversy instead of sort of more thoughtful spaces where we get to talk about, you know, the ongoing legacy and continuation of racism. I'm not resentful, but I'm fatigued because it does take me away from the things I want to do. Like, I want to write fiction that's not about racism in America primarily or solely. And I'm sure a lot of other writers of color want that same freedom, the freedom to not be bothered. But that's, you know, a pipe dream.
One of the added stings of Michael Derek Hudson's fraud is that he could have invented any name. He was trying to gain advantage by appropriating a culture, not an individual identity. But his choice was personal on some level. Yifen Cho is the name of a woman who went to the same high school at the same time as he. For Jenny Zhang's family, choosing a name was a different kind of calculation when they moved from Shanghai and thought more American-sounding names would help their prospects at getting a job or prevent Jenny from being bullied at school. So the choice of a Chinese name has a different kind of resonance for her.
Yeah, this middle-aged white guy gets to have the best parts of a Asian or Chinese name, according to him, which is better chances of getting published. And meanwhile, actual Asian people are just trying to survive and not be made a target by hiding the names that they were born with.
American racial biases and economics have long benefited people with names like mine, which could easily have been spat out by the white name generator. Alexei's use of what he called racial nepotism led to a passionate, frank, and widespread conversation about inequity, yes, but also about poetry. Now, how often does that happen? At the very least, the flap may lead curious observers to take a look at what else is in Best American Poetry 2015. Or maybe to explore other collections or authors or threads to new voices and new names. Thanks to Jenny Schuessler and Jenny Zhang for speaking with us for this story. And there's a link to more in the collection and the passionate response to Michael Derek Hudson's inclusion in it at wordofmouthradio.org. Conversations about race aren't easy. Another subject that many people shy away from, sex. For parents of young children, explaining how babies are made is difficult but unavoidable discussion. There are templates of sorts. You can go with the birds or the bees, or maybe when a mommy and a daddy really love each other very much, or perhaps the more direct route, that men have penises and women have vaginas. But at a time when more and more children are adopted or parented by single-sex couples or conceived through surrogates, and our understanding of gender is becoming more flexible, is there a more creative way to explain where babies come from? Well, one new book has a different approach, answering the question without any gendered terms at all. Corey Silverberg is a sexuality educator and author of What Makes a Baby. It's the first book in a series that teaches young readers about gender, sexuality, and sexual health. Corey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So where'd you get the idea to write a book like this?
Well, when I grew up, actually my mom was a children's librarian and my dad was a sex therapist, and I grew up in Canada. And so I had all these, you know, I had all the books that were available about where babies come from and about sexuality, but none of them really fit for me. I was what now we would call a gender nonconforming kid. So anyway, so I grew up and I kind of always knew that the books that were out there weren't enough. They weren't for everyone. And then all of my friends started having kids, and a lot of my friends are transgender. And there's a specific family that I really wrote the book with. The first version of this book was written for a specific family that was a trans family. The dad was trans, the mom wasn't. They had a 4-year-old and they were having another baby, and I was very close with the 4-year-old, and he started asking questions. And as you already said, all of the books that are out there, they, you know, pretty much they say, well, you get a sperm from your dad, an egg from your mom, and they're the two people who raise you. And they describe a family that more and more is not, I mean, you know, it's a smaller and smaller part of the world of families that we have. Mm. So Beto's dad asked if I would, you know, he knew I was always talking about, oh, one day I'll write this book. And he said, you know, could you just get on it and just do it? And so I did it. I wrote a story that worked for them. And of course, what happened over a 2-year process of writing and rewriting is we discovered that it kind of works for everyone.
Well, let me ask you how it works, because I'm thinking that, mm-hmm. you know, whether you're adopted, whether your parents right. got you through some sort of surrogacy or technology,
right.
I mean, those kids
exactly.
can feel kind of left out of the equation that if there's a mommy in it, when a daddy really loves a mommy.
Right, exactly, right. And even, like in this case, my friend's children, they have a mom and a dad, but the sperm didn't come from the dad, which can be true for trans families, but as you said, I mean, it can be true for a lot of straight families, too, and a lot of, like, you know, cisgender families, I guess, non-trans families. So the way that we do it, the big difference is, number one, as you said, you know, we don't talk about moms and dads. My approach as a sex educator is to try to figure out what we can say that's true for everyone. And in 2015, what we can say is, you need an egg, you need a sperm, and you need a uterus. And we can't say much more about where those parts are, where they come from. So the way our book works is that we talk about what you need to make a baby. There's a lot of like beautiful illustrations of families and love, but what we do is we actually leave it to the parents to actually tell the story of how the sperm and the egg came together, and if they want to share whose sperm and egg that was, right? So it might be this, a very simple story of like, well, it was your mom and your dad. Or it might be that Uncle Jack helped us. Or it might be that we tell a story about a doctor that helped. What I discovered was a lot of families that are using reproductive technologies, you know, that aren't necessarily using surrogates per se, that might be even using their own sperm and egg, but that they are actually interested in telling their kids the fact that it wasn't easy, right? One of the problems with a lot of these books is it makes it seem like it's the easiest thing in the world to have a baby. And the truth is it's actually, as a lot of us know, it's not the easiest thing in the world.
Well, you did work with this illustrator, Fiona Smith, and the art is just delightful. The sperm and the egg each come with their own stories, and there's kind of all of these illustrated stories
inside of them. DNA. It's our idea of DNA.
Right. But there's also, yes, the beings, like, they're absolutely gender neutral. It's like some people have uteruses, some people don't.
Yeah. We even kept it, I mean, the language that we use is sort of some bodies have and some
bodies
don't.
That's it.
Because, and I should say that at the end of the book, we see people who are very clearly gendered. So it isn't about, like, taking gender out of life. But the truth is that sperm and egg, even though, of course, we think of sperm as male, and often you know, in other books we see them, the sperm wears a bow tie and the egg is wearing a tutu. But the truth is that sperm and egg are not gendered, right? They're cells. They're cellular. Gender is something that people have. Gender isn't something that our cells have. So, you know, this has been my approach for the past 20 years as a sex educator, is I just try to take gender out of where it doesn't need to be. And the other thing I'll say is that little kids don't have a problem with this. Like, there are some adults that maybe have a little, they're not really sure about the approach. In our experience, like, this makes perfect sense to little kids.
Well, I wonder, okay, so you talked about the essential role of parents or whoever is reading this book to children having to take a role in the explanation, right?
Yes.
But kids are used to looking at all of those books where the feminine is wearing a tutu or, you know, the man is wearing a bow tie. So is it confusing to them to see bodies without, you know, I don't know, they make the women's lips bigger or breasts or
hair
or whatever?
You know what? So in our experience, now this book is written for 4 to 6-year-olds. And so the younger the kids are, the less confusing it is. Because, you know, we aren't born with some hardwired understanding of sex or gender. We may be born with some aspects of it for ourselves, but we don't have a, you know, social understanding of what gender is. It's something we learn. So the older the kid, the weirder this stuff looks, because they are expecting, as you said, they're expecting certain, you know, hip-to-waist ratio. They wouldn't know it, but they're expecting it. But with really young kids, we found that with these illustrations, they just kind of fall into it, partly because it's also a little bit magical. Like, Fiona's not older, she's near my age. But
that's the illustrator, Fiona Smith.
And the style is a little psychedelic, but I think that's fine. I think that, you know, as an educator, again, when it comes to sex, we often think we have to be totally scientific because we're kind of nervous about the subject. But, of course, making babies is actually magic, right? I don't know if you have any babies in your life, but like I do, and the fact that we humans can make a baby, it is a total miracle, and it's totally magical. And the idea that we have to explain it in a way that is dry and only scientific didn't appeal to Fiona and I, and in fact, we found that the kids love it. So young kids have no problem with these kind of like bodies that almost look like trees. But certainly adults do sometimes, and you know, that's fine.
I wonder about the adults, because here, I know you're in Canada, but this book is selling briskly in the United States, and
here in the
U.S., there are a lot of cultural debates over what is gender binary conforming heterosexual. Have you had outright resistance to this book?
Yeah, absolutely. There are people, so the one thing with this book, as I think you said this in the opening, we don't ever reference moms and dads.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that not because we have a problem with moms and dads. I have many moms in my life and I love them. But because not everyone has both. And certainly not everyone uses those names for them, right? And some people don't have either. And we want, you know, I'm a sex educator. I think that the kid in foster care who's actually having a pretty tough time in the world deserves exactly the same kind of sex education as the kid with the normative family that has all the resources and has a mom and a dad. And, you know, so the fact that we took the words mom and dad out in order to be more inclusive was something that that some people really don't like. And also some people don't like the fact that we say that some bodies have eggs and some bodies have sperm. We don't say women have eggs and men have sperm, because the truth is not all women have eggs. And that's not just an issue of trans. You know, trans bodies, I'll point that out. There are also some women who are born women, who everyone would, you know, doctors would refer to as women, who actually have no viable eggs.
Right.
And the way that traditional sex education is done shames those women and tells them that they're not real women. And that's part of, even though my focus is on trans inclusion, you know, the way that we talk about sex and gender actually leaves out a lot of people. So that's my little argument. But to answer your question, some people are not comfortable with it. And people are not comfortable. They don't want to they don't want to accept the reality, which is that there's way more than two genders and more than two sexes. And that's fine. I mean, I am Canadian, as you said, and I have no interest. I'm not really pushing an agenda. So I think the book works for everyone, but it won't be for everyone.
Well, Corey, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Corey Silverberg is a sexuality educator and member of the Come As You Are Cooperative and author of What Makes a Baby. That's the first book in a series that teaches readers about gender, sexuality, and sexual health. The more recent addition to the series, Sex is a Funny Word. You can find more about both books at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Some conversations are tough to have with kids, especially when there's a big generation gap, which is why so many grandchildren never really get to know their grandparents as people. One adult woman made an effort to become acquainted with her grandfather years after his death. This story comes to us from producer Sarah Neal.
My grandfather, Ebert Whipple, was born in southern Indiana in 1910. He always carried chewing gum in his shirt pocket. His left hand was paralyzed from polio. He wore pressed trousers every day. He talked about dying a lot, which I hated, and he always called me Sally. He died in 1989, and that's all I managed to remember about him until my mom started finding messages he left behind. I grew up 2 hours north of my grandparents, and I visited them every summer at their house on the corner of Washington and Market Streets, the same house where my mother lives today. She calls me often. "I found something," she says, and she tells me about a collection of name tags that say, "Hello, my name is Ebert Whipple, class of 1938, carefully pasted to the inside of a closet, or a note he scribbled to her on a page of a book she gave him in 1969. It said, "Reread in 1984. Thank you. This is a wonderful present." 2 months ago, she found a message for me.
"Good morning, Sally. This is your maternal grandfather speaking to you this morning, Ebert Whipple, from a cozy little broadcasting recording studio in 1007 West Market Street, Salem, Indiana. Today is the 10th day of January, 1974. Now, if you think it's easy, you ought to sit down with one of these microphones sometime and try talking to a 2-year-old girl that isn't present. Now, sir, it's not the easiest thing in the world to sit down with a microphone and just kind of talk about something that you don't have any business talking about."
Apparently, back in 1975, when I was a toddler, my grandfather sat himself down on the front porch with his tape recording equipment and started talking. I think he expected my mom to find the tapes a little sooner, maybe when I was in college, certainly before I got married.
"There are advantages in marrying a poor, ambitious boy who will make a success and be a self-made man. That's a pretty good kind. There are also some advantages to marrying a smart, alert, athletic young fellow that can go in business with his dad or uncle and eventually inherit $1 million. There are some advantages to that. Is anybody still listening? Everybody still listening? Hold up your hand. Ah, there it is.
When I hear this, I picture him sitting on that porch, thinking about how scary it will be for me to make a very big decision at a time in life when I haven't seen or done enough to feel quite qualified to make it. And I hear that he wanted to be there for me. All of a sudden, it doesn't matter if he's old-fashioned and the tapes are a couple of years late. They're like a little Valentine to me. A chance to know my grandfather as a real, tangible person, as an adult.
I suppose that your Grandma Whipple and I have had as happy a marriage as anybody could be.
This is my favorite story.
Now, it wasn't always smooth sailing.
It's on the second side of tape two, and it's the one I learned the most from. According to my grandfather, he and my grandmother fought quite a bit when they first got married. So to stop arguing, they decided to alternate being the boss. He got to be in charge the first week, and she took the second.
Well, you know, that had some interesting ramifications. It was a lot of fun, you know, a young married couple. If I got a little bit teed off with Louise, I could tell her to go over and stand in the corner for 5 minutes, and she'd have to go stand there for 5 minutes. Oh, that was fun. But you must wait until the next week. If she told me to go stand in the corner for 10 minutes, then I had to go stand in the corner for 10 minutes. Well, I'll tell you what that finally led to. That finally led to my deciding that I'd better be awfully, awfully good to her the week that I was boss. So that the week she was boss, she wouldn't take advantage of it. So, we actually did this. This is really the truth.
Some types of humor just aren't available to you when you're young. I don't know if adults hide this stuff or children don't understand it and tune it out. I didn't even know that my grandfather, who seemed so obsessed with death, had a sense of humor. But there it is, recorded for the ages. My dear, sweet grandparents sent each other to the corner. It's beautiful. Before listening to these tapes, I thought the messages my mother found, the note in the book, the name tags plastered to the closet, were my grandfather's way of reassuring himself. Leaving a reminder of his existence to be found after he died, but I've changed my mind. I think my grandfather left messages behind because he had a lot to share and realized he didn't have enough time left to share it all. Think about it. If you really loved your granddaughter, but she was too little to understand who you were or to understand the advice you had to give, what would you do? I think sitting yourself down on the porch and recording 7 hours of tape so she could listen to it when she's 30 works pretty well.
Well, anyway, here's best wishes to you. And don't be surprised if you don't agree with everything I say. I didn't say what I had in mind with the idea that it was right. I just wanted you to think about it. Draw your own conclusions, make your own decisions, because you're the one that's going to have to live by your choices. I'm not. So make the choices and then abide by them. Make them wisely enough that it won't be too much difficulty to abide by them. And with that in mind, I think I'll say good afternoon. Bye now.
And that story was produced by Sarah Neal.
If I should write a book for you that brought me fame and fortune too, that book would be like my heart and me, dedicated to you and...
Thank you so much for your listening time today. Hopefully, we provided you with some tools and maybe even a little bit of courage to approach a difficult conversation. There is much more to hear and explore on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can sign up for the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, consider writing a review. That helps other people find it. And as we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.